All right, good morning, everybody. So I hope you had a good spring break, took some time off, studied even a little bit harder. I'm not sure what you needed to do, okay, but hopefully you didn't have to work like a fiend on top of everything. So we're almost done with autonomic nervous system. Basically, I think I'm done talking about it, except I just want to review a couple things about autonomic nervous system and then move on to senses. And don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet. Then let's see, what else? Some other announcements. I think we have a test scheduled 1 week from today, and we got to get through heart. All right, so we're going to finish up senses and heart this week, and then another test, and that means then only one test left, which is fantastic. Semester will be over. And I think there are some practicums starting this week, so I'm going to hold an open lab tomorrow evening, and I believe the time is from 4 till 7. Is that what is written on the board in the lab, 4 to 7? Yeah? Does anybody know? Did anybody go to lab today? Yeah? Does that sound good? 4 to 7, Tuesday. Okay, and then I think there's another open lab. Sorry, haha. Then there's another open lab, I believe, on Friday. Okay, and I don't know the time for that one. Probably morning. 10 to noon. Okay? Sometimes it runs a little bit longer than that, so the instructor couldn't stay very late in the afternoon, so she just put down till noon, but probably would stay, you know, a couple minutes later if you needed to. And I see a question. A pretest for SI? You know, I'm not really sure. We'll have to talk to the SI leader about that. Okay. So how many pretests did you have so far? Every test you had one? Okay. Well, and were they helpful?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, huh? Okay, well, I'll talk to our SI leader and just see. My guess, you know, she has been so diligent. And on top of things, my guess is that she already has one ready to go. Was there an SI meeting this morning?
No.
Okay. Okay. And did you guys know that ahead of time, or is that just like a surprise?
No, she didn't show up.
Oh, she didn't show up. Okay, well, yeah, I don't have any news in that regard. Okay, so I don't know if she comes into class this morning. Let's give her a round of applause, actually, because I think she's actually helped out quite a bit for students that routinely go to SI, right? Okay, so I haven't heard one thing or another. So don't forget the sign-in sheet. All right, autonomic nervous system. What are the two main divisions of the autonomic nervous system? Parasympathetic and sympathetic. This is right. And what's the relationship between them? They're antagonistic to each other, right? And that's 99.9% of the time that's true. So if the parasympathetic is excitatory, the sympathetic is going to be inhibitory to an innervated organ. Okay? You should be able to contrast in your mind the difference between a somatic motor pathway and an autonomic motor pathway, and I think I have that on the screen right now. Let me turn around and take a look. Yeah? I see our projector is getting a little weak. Maybe it will warm up. I'm not sure. So how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to effector organ for a somatic motor pathway?
One.
Just one. And what is a somatic pathway? What's in the everyday language, what could you say? Voluntary, I like that. And where do voluntary motor neurons go to? What's the one thing in your body you have voluntary control over? Skeletal muscle, that's the only thing that you have control over. Okay. All right, so that's somatic. As opposed to autonomic, how many neurons does it take to get from central nervous system to effector organ?
Two.
And what do we call those two? There's a preganglionic and a postganglionic. Yeah. Okay, and that's true for parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, except for there's one exception in the sympathetic nervous system. There really is only one motor neuron. And what organ does that go to? And it's a modified ganglion cell, but it's actually in an organ someplace. And it's the adrenal gland, the adrenal medulla. Right, so the ganglion cell or the postganglionic cell really is a cell within the adrenal medulla. And when the preganglionic cell stimulates the adrenal medulla, what does the adrenal medulla do? Sounds like a song. It secretes epinephrine and norepinephrine, and then that's picked up by the circulatory system and taken that sympathetic signal all over your body wherever the circulatory system goes. Okay. So the parasympathetic nervous system, when it innervates something, it usually just goes to one place and innervates one organ at a time, but sympathetic autonomic nervous system broadcasts a signal pretty much all over your body where it has global effects or systemic effects all over your body. All right, because there's a lot of divergence and convergence of signals. All right, so here you have that autonomic ganglion. What is the neurotransmitter that's used in all autonomic ganglion between the pre- and post-ganglionic fiber? It's going to be acetylcholine. Okay. And then here is a postganglionic nerve, and let's just say this one is parasympathetic. If this is parasympathetic, what's the neurotransmitter that's used on the postganglionic fiber? It's acetylcholine again. But what happens if this was a sympathetic fiber? What would be the neurotransmitter? Then it would be norepinephrine, right? So you have to know what neurotransmitter is primarily used by parasympathetic versus sympathetic nervous system. All right. The other thing you should recall is the outflow. How does parasympathetic outflow leave your central nervous system? It's called cranial sacral outflow, right? From cranial nerves and then through sacral nerves. And what about sympathetic outflow? It's thoracolumbar. It leaves the thoracic vertebrae and some lumbar vertebrae. All right, and the other contrast that you should know is where are these autonomic ganglia located for the parasympathetic nervous system? Are they close to the spinal cord or close to the effector organ? They're very close to the effector organ. So the preganglionic fiber is long and the postganglionic fiber is very short for parasympathetic. Now what about for sympathetic? Okay. The preganglionic fiber is very short because the ganglia, the sympathetic chain, are on either side of the vertebral column, very close to the CNS, and there's even the collateral ganglia or prevertebral ganglia that are right in front of the spinal cord. So the preganglionic fibers are short for sympathetic nerves, and the postganglionic fibers are long. They have to go all the way to the effector organ from basically the vertebral column. All right, so you should know those two kinds of ganglia, the sympathetic chain versus collateral ganglia. And then also you should know in an autonomic pathway which nerve fiber is myelinated. Are they both myelinated or neither? The preganglionic is myelinated and the postganglionic is non-myelinated, right? Okay. All right, so that's pretty much about it. But I think that you should also be able to draw a sympathetic outflow pathway. All right, and I think we did this right as we were leaving last time, starting with the spinal cord. So here is spinal cord. And what do we got right here? This is gray matter. So what can leave in the thoracic region? What kind of outflow will leave your thoracic region? It's the sympathetic, right? So we're looking at sympathetic outflow. So there's going to be a nerve cell body right here. That's the lateral horn. And then an axon is going to leave, what is this called? Yeah? That's the ventral root. All right, but let's just kind of draw everything. So this is going to be the dorsal root, and then there's this thing here. This is the dorsal root ganglia. So which way are signals going in for the dorsal root? Are they motor or sensory? They're always going to be 100% sensory. The ventral root is 100% motor. All right, the dorsal root, ventral root merge together. What do we call this thing right here? This is the, that's a spinal nerve. Okay, and then since we're considering sympathetic outflow, it's going to leave the spinal nerve and it's going to go into the sympathetic chain ganglia. All right, so sympathetic chain ganglia right here. And this is all just one neuron. Right? So this is, what neuron is this going into the sympathetic chain? This is the preganglionic fiber. And is the preganglionic fiber myelinated or non-myelinated? It's myelinated. So here is a rami communicantes. What color is it since it's myelinated? It's white. So this is the white ramus communicantes. It comes in, and then it might synapse. And here's the postganglionic fiber. It's going to go back into the spinal nerve, right? And so what is this pathway? Since this is the postganglionic fiber, is it myelinated or non-myelinated? Non-myelinated. What color is it then? Gray. So this is the gray ramus communicantes. And then that signal can go a couple of different ways. It can go to a posterior region or an anterior region. So what is this thing, this nerve that's going to some posterior region to the spinal cord? This is the? Okay, this is the dorsal ramus. Right, so I'm going to abbreviate it RA. And this is the ventral ramus. And don't forget, these are both mixed signals. Now, the only other thing that you should realize is that sometimes sympathetic signals pass right through the sympathetic chain ganglia, right? So maybe there's another nerve that's coming right through here, and it passes right through to a collateral ganglion someplace in front of the vertebral column. So sometimes we call this a collateral ganglion. Signals come in, all right, where they then synapse. All right, so what's always the name of this nervous tissue that goes from the sympathetic chain passing right through to a collateral ganglion?
Splanchnic.
Yeah, that's a splanchnic nerve. I'll abbreviate SPN, not just SN, because I use that for spinal nerve. All right, so make sure you can trace that out. Okay, anybody have a question on that pathway? Yeah. Yeah, let's take a look. I think I have a picture. Right? That's not a bad picture. Not a bad picture. This is a better picture. I can't see it very well. All right, so here you can see, here is nerve cell body in the lateral horn, gray matter, right, in some level like T5 through L2. And this preganglionic fiber leaves the ventral root, enters the spinal nerve, goes into the ventral ramus, but it doesn't follow that nerve to effector organ. It moves through the white ramus communicantes, and this one passes right through the sympathetic chain via the splanchnic nerve to a prevertebral ganglion. So prevertebral ganglion and a collateral ganglion are exactly the same thing. Where it synapses and then the postganglionic nerve fiber goes to the effector organ. Another possible case would be maybe it synapses in the sympathetic chain. And then where does that postganglionic nerve go? Goes back into the spinal nerve via what? This gray ramus communicantes right there. Okay, so you probably have to look at a couple different figures in your book to get all the labels on there, but your book has a number of good examples. All right, and then the only other one that's a little bit different, okay, is notice the nerve going to the adrenal medulla. One nerve goes all the way through. Cell body in the lateral horn of the gray matter spinal cord, goes in the ventral root, all right, enters the spinal nerve, white ramus communicantes, passes right through the sympathetic chain, becomes a splanchnic nerve, which goes directly to the adrenal medulla, notice without synapsing, and then these cells within the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic nerve cells. When they're stimulated, what do? They don't send action potentials any place or electrical activity. They automatically just release epinephrine and some norepinephrine, which is picked up by a capillary, which is distributed all over the body, distributing that sympathetic signal everywhere that your blood goes. Okay? All right, so don't forget, sometimes sympathetic nerves can arise or descend within the sympathetic chain ganglia to go to different places in the body. because certainly you do need sympathetic nerves going to, for instance, your eyes. What does anybody remember what sympathetic activity in the iris does? What does it do? It causes dilation. Okay? So don't forget, signals can only leave from T1 through L5, but signals still have to go to your face, right? So they ascend through the sympathetic chain and then course the rest of the way up into your head. Okay. All right, so I think that's pretty good for autonomic nervous system. Make sure you can answer all those questions that I have in your notes. And if you have any questions, make sure you bring them up next time or in lab, or you can even hit up your SI leader as well. Yeah. You want to go over them real quick? All right, so these three right here. What is the general name for the chemicals norepinephrine and epinephrine, which are secreted from the adrenal medulla? General name. So general name, I think I mean, let's see if I can remember what I was actually after. But how about a general name meaning what some people might use in everyday language without taking a science class? Okay, so I would say adrenaline and noradrenaline. So noradrenaline would be norepinephrine, and epinephrine is what we call adrenaline. And what might be one reason why people call it adrenaline? What organ secretes adrenaline? The adrenal gland. Okay, so that's probably why they named it that. All right, question number two. Are the quasi-postganglionic cells, so quasi means what? They're sort of like a postganglionic cell, of the adrenal medulla, nerve cells, or endocrine cells? If I was going to pick one or the other, I would say they're probably functioning more like an endocrine cell because they're secreting a compound directly that's picked up by the circulatory system. So in that particular case, epinephrine and norepinephrine are acting more like a hormone than a neurotransmitter because they're being distributed by the blood. All right, so again, this question again illustrates that the nervous system must be thought of, or that the nervous system along with the endocrine system should be thought of as what, a system that is meshed together in a couple places, especially the adrenal medulla right here. You can't say it's really nervous system or endocrine system because it's really functioning as both. And in advanced classes, indeed, we always teach, we don't break the nervous system down into one part and endocrine system down into another part. We actually teach it as an integrated system. We teach it as the neuroendocrine system. All right, last question. What's the general name for chemical norepinephrine, which is secreted from the postganglion? General name. Noradrenaline. I might have to come back to you on Wednesday to see if I was thinking of something else there. Because it sounds like I'm asking that question twice. Noradrenaline. It's the general name for the chemical. Oh, you know what? I think maybe another general name could be what? Neurotransmitter. Right, so norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter. It's a general name for the chemical norep, which is secreted from the postganglionic sympathetic neuron. Norepinephrine in this case would be a neurotransmitter because it's released by a neuron. Let me go back and read this other question. What's the general name for chemicals norepinephrine and epinephrine, which is secreted from the adrenal medulla? I think I see what I was getting at. Right, usually you think of norepinephrine as being a neurotransmitter, but when it's released from the adrenal gland, it's acting as a hormone. Okay, so I guess there's different ways we could answer this question. All right, norepinephrine and epinephrine, for the first question right here, you could consider them hormones. It's true. They're also called adrenaline and noradrenaline. So all depends on what answers I give you on the test if I ask you this question, okay? All right, so that's it for autonomic nervous system, okay? All right, so I'm going to close this one down. And I'm going to close this one down. And move on to senses. That's awfully small. So I think I don't want that one. Okay, so senses. Senses are important because these are systems in our body that allow us to communicate with our environment, to be aware of our environment. And there are different ways that we can classify different kinds of senses. And the ones that we're going to talk about in this chapter are what we call special senses as opposed to general senses. And I think we talked about general senses already when we were looking at the integument, the skin. So for instance, we talked about certain kinds of receptors that you have for cold, which are free nerve endings. So if I took an ice cube and put it on your forehead, could you tell that it was cold? Yeah, okay. And if I took that ice cube and I put it on your kneecap, could you tell it was cold? Yeah. Or your elbow, or the back of your hand, right? So you have temperature receptors where on your body? Everywhere on your body. And that just kind of illustrates what we consider what a general sense is. A general sense is a sense that has receptors for that particular modality all over your body. No matter where that stimulus is applied, you can appreciate that stimulus. So could you think of another general sense besides cold? Pain. That's right. If I took a pencil and jabbed you in the arm, you could tell, or in your side, or your earlobe, or no matter where, right, you could feel pain. What's another one that's general, all over your body? Touch, vibration, for instance, those are all general senses. Okay. And there's something else too, and that's proprioception is a general sense. Proprioception, you get information about muscle tension and joint position, and you have these receptors in all your muscles, all your tendons, and all your joints, all over your body. So that's another general sense, even though it sounds like it's kind of a special word, proprioception, but you have that all over your body. Okay, now let's talk about a special sense. A special sense is one where you only have one place, or maybe two places on your body where you can appreciate that modality of energy. All right, and a good example of that would be, for instance, taste. If I spilled sugar on the tabletop right here and I put my fingertips on the sugar, could I tell it was sweet?
No.
Or my elbow? No, right? So where do you only have the sense of taste? In your mouth, that's right. And so that's a special sense. So special senses mean that you have those sense organs in one or two very localized regions on your body, and nowhere else on your body will respond to that particular stimulus. So what about vision? If I took a flashlight and shined it in your belly button, could you see that light? No. Or your kneecap? No. Or your ear? No, you can't see anything, only in your eyes, and you have two very complex organs to perceive that kind of energy, light energy. So that's a special sense. So the special senses are taste, and that's what we call gustation, and then smell. Again, you can't smell with your fingertips, okay, or earlobe or anything like that. All right, so that is also another sense that's called olfaction. You can only smell with your nose. Vision is another. Hearing, only with your ears. And there are two other senses associated with the ears that we're going to look at. And that's our two equilibrium senses that give you a sense of maintaining balance in your body, postural balance. All right, so let's talk about olfaction first. All right, so don't forget, olfaction is what? A special sense because you can only smell with your nose. All right, and the reason why you smell things is because they have to be airborne. There has to be molecules in the air called odors or odorant molecules. Those have to enter your nose, and they have to bind to receptors which are on nerve fibers that are in your nose. And this is really kind of a strange place because in your nasal cavity, that's the only place in your whole body where you actually have nerves that are dangling outside of your body just into free space. All other nerves are protected deep inside your body, but these in your nose are just dangling down inside your nasal cavity. All right, and then odorant molecules can bind to them, and when they bind to those receptors, those nerve fibers then initiate an action potential, and it sends that action potential to the brain. And what nerve takes that information to the brain? Yeah, the olfactory bulb, but what cranial nerve is that? Okay, and your nose is what? Like your most anterior part of your face, what's the most anterior cranial nerve? Number one, yeah, and then we name them two as we go, three, four, five, as we go, of course, posterior on the base of the brain. So cranial nerve number one is the olfactory nerve, and that's purely a sensory nerve. It's not motor at all, so it's not mixed. All right, there are a lot of discussion on what the senses that we can appreciate with our nose are. Sometimes people like to break things down into primary colors or primary taste sensations or primary odor sensations in the nose. And probably most people agree that there are seven primary odors. Like there's a sense of flowery and etheric, musky, camphorous, sweaty, rotten, stinging. Right? These are primary senses. And when you smell something, they're a combination of all of these different kinds of senses. Right, and then you can see what kind of molecule actually triggers these different kinds of receptors. Right, but there might actually be thousands of different kinds of receptors. And so we're always learning more and more about the sense of olfaction all the time. All right, so let's take a look at where these nerves are. So here you can see, thanks. So here, don't forget, here's a sign-in sheet. If anybody needs a sign-in sheet, go ahead and just pass it back one more time. All right, so here you see the nasal cavity and the olfactory bulb, and from the olfactory bulb there are olfactory nerves that move through. Oh, what bone is that right here? Oh, I tell you what, let's move over to this exploded view right here. What bone is that? That's the ethmoid bone. Yeah, and in particular what the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone, and the cribriform plate has all those different holes in it that we call olfactory foramina, and passing through the olfactory foramina, right, are these filaments of the olfactory nerve that go right through the epithelium of your nasal cavity, and then here are some cilia projections of that olfactory nerve actually dangling down inside your nasal cavity, and these are the things that have receptors on them, so odorant molecules can bind to them, and that initiates electrical activity in the cell, which then sends signals to the brain. All right, so can you see what kind of cell this is right here? Was that on the last test? Oh yeah, you guys just had a test. Did you guys have a test? No, that was a different class. Never mind. But was this on your last nervous system test, I think? Sure. What kind of nerve cell does this look like? Okay, yeah, you got multipolar, you got unipolar, and then these here are bipolar, right? Because we said bipolar neurons are associated with special senses like we have right here in the nose. All right, then here we have some support cells. All right, and a basal cell, and these basal cells are actually stem cells, because these bipolar cells right here, since they're actually dangling outside of your body, they have a really rough life. They have a very short lifespan, right? And then they die, and if they were to die and not replaced, what would happen? You would lose the sense of smell, right? So these cells, these basal cells, then are stem cells. They regenerate or replace these bipolar cells when they die. And I think that's probably, to me, that's really interesting, because what is one thing that you know about nerve injury? How well does your body recuperate from nerve injury, especially central nervous system, like spinal cord? Not at all, right? But look where we have in our bodies, all of us, these stem cells right here that can regenerate neurons. So it'd be really fascinating sometime if somebody could take some of these cells, grow them in a test tube, maybe after somebody had a spinal cord injury, reach inside your nose, pull out a few of those cells, grow them in quantity, transplant them to your spinal cord, and have them replace those neurons that were damaged, and regrow the function of somebody's spinal cord. That would be really interesting. Okay, we'll probably find more and more areas of a person's body that have stem cells, maybe that we can use for transplants in the future. Now, what's one really nice thing about getting, this would be, for example, an autograft. So what's one nice thing about getting a transplant from some other part of your body? Why is that such a good thing, as opposed to getting an organ or some tissue from somebody else? Why is an autograft so much better than getting a graft or a donation from some... Yeah, rejection basically goes away. So you don't have to be on anti-rejection therapy for the rest of your life. So you're not going to be immunocompromised. So actually, it's really nice if somebody could figure out how to do that. But what's one concern that I might have? If we transplant somebody's olfactory stem cells to their back, maybe you smell with your back now. Okay? I don't know. I'm just kind of being silly. But that's just something to just wonder about. Okay. All right, so that is the olfactory system. All right, so you have those undifferentiated basal cells produce receptor cells, right? And these are really the only neurons that we're really familiar with that can replace themselves. Okay. The sense of gustation is the sensation of taste. So you have taste buds, which are special receptor areas that are on your tongue. All right, so let me see if I can find some of these things. All right, this looks good right here. Okay, so when you look in a mirror and stick your tongue out at yourself, you can see these papillae, these things sticking up off the surface of your tongue. And a lot of people call those taste buds, but actually those are not taste buds. Those are just what we call papillae. So if we look at one of these things right here, this is a papillae, and then with a microscope, look at this one area right here, and it looks like it's about this size right here. All right, so this is really what is a taste bud. And so what do you see making up a taste bud? What are these things right here? Do you see like millions of cells or thousands of cells or what? Just a handful of cells. What do you need to see just a handful of cells? Can you see that with your naked eye? No. You need a microscope, right? So taste buds are really microscopic. You can't see that with your naked eye. So when you look in the mirror, what you see are what? Accumulation of thousands of these taste buds that are covering a papillae. And depending on what part of the tongue you look at, there are some that are very large on the posterior part, right? Those are the circumvallate papillae. And the papillae on the tip of your tongue and actually over the most of the body of your tongue, those are what we call the fungiform papillae.
Why is it called a fungiform?
Fungiform because it looks spongy. It looks kind of spongy. Yeah, it doesn't look like a smooth surface. It looks velvety. Okay, it has that little velvety appearance. Fungiform. What does fungiform mean to you? Is that a Latin root? Does it? Yeah, mold has a nice, you know, a soft appearance. It's not shiny. Okay, yeah. Okay, so these cells right here are receptor cells as well. Here is a little pore. So a molecule that's dissolved in saliva has to enter this taste pore, and it has to bind to a receptor on these receptor cells, which then sends electrical information to the brain, action potentials to the brain. So tastant molecules have to bind to these, okay, these gustatory hairs or cilia on these taste cells right here. Okay, and we have a number of primary taste sensations. Just like I mentioned them to you for olfaction, they're sweet, sour, bitter, salty. These are the four kind of common ones, and then there's one that's relatively new, and that's the sense of umami. And umami doesn't have a taste necessarily, but it gives you a sense of deliciousness, all right, or satisfaction when you eat that kind of food. And one of the molecules that binds to umami receptors is glutamate. It's an amino acid. What are amino acids used for?
Protein.
Yeah, making proteins, and glutamate is just one of those amino acids that when you eat glutamate, it gives you that sense of deliciousness. And it's used as a flavoring in a lot of foods, not that it provides a salty or sweet kind of taste, but it just gives you the sense of what? Fulfillment when you eat that food. And what is it? How is it labeled?
It's
How's it added to food? What's the kind of chemical that's added to food?
MSG.
Yeah, MSG or monosodium glutamate. That's the form. And some people can't eat a lot of it because it might stimulate migraine headaches or something. Okay. All right, so then these senses pass through cranial nerve, number 7, that's the facial nerve, and then some from the tongue, that's number 9. And then these send signals, you don't have to know this. But you do have to know that sensory signals, right, do have to pass through the thalamus before they get to the gustatory cortex in the parietal lobe. You should probably know that the gustatory cortex is the parietal lobe. Oh, one thing I didn't mention about the sense of smell, and that is the mitral cells, these are axons from the nose that send signals to the brain, send signals to the limbic system, and the limbic system is a very important system for memories and eliciting emotions. And you might recall, maybe you were on a vacation someplace, maybe you went skiing somewhere, and you just were walking around town or something, and you happened to find a store, and you found a leather jacket, and you've always wanted a leather jacket for the last 25 years and never bought one. So you finally broke down and bought a leather jacket. And a leather jacket has what? A certain kind of smell or aroma to it, right? And you're on vacation having a really nice time. So once you get back home, and even maybe 5 or 10 years later, you go into the closet and you put on that leather jacket and you smell that aroma, right? That sense can take you back almost immediately, right? 20 years to where you're having that really nice time with friends and family, right? So smell elicits memories probably like no other kind of sense that you have. And maybe you've experienced that. All right, vision. Vision is another special sense, and only our eyes allow us to perceive light. We have photoreceptors in our eyes. And so there are some structures in the eye that allow us to see light, and then there are other structures that help protect the eye or help allow the eye to see properly. And those are what we call accessory structures. All right, so eyebrows and eyelids are what we call accessory structures. Because they protect the eye. They don't really perceive light, but they help protect that very special kind of organ. All right, and an eyelid, probably you learned in lab, another name for an eyelid is a palpebra. All right, and you got an upper, a superior, and an inferior palpebra. Those are your eyelids. All right, and then what else do you have on palpebra to help protect your eye? You got the eyebrows above your eye, and then you have eyelashes on the palpebrae, all right, to prevent objects from falling into your eye. The conjunctiva is a mucous membrane that lines the interior surface of the palpebrae and even on some of the surface of the eyeball itself. That's a mucous membrane. And that mucous membrane has to be lubricated. Some of the lubrication comes from tarsal glands that are embedded in the palpebrae. But other lubrication comes from the lacrimal gland. And the lacrimal gland is a tear gland, which is superior and lateral to the eye. Okay, and it secretes mucus and water and some lysozyme. What does lysozyme do? Okay, lysozyme can break down bacteria. So it's a bacteriostatic agent. So it helps fight infection in the eye. It can attack bacteria. The lacrimal gland also secretes antibodies that fights infection. All right, and let's take a look, see if I can find. Lacrimal gland. Let me show you. So here's lacrimal gland, right here. All right, it secretes tears, which then flows over the eye. So it moistens and lubricates the eye so your eye doesn't turn into a potato chip, right? And then those tears move through the lacrimal canaliculi, right through the lacrimal punctum, and then into the lacrimal duct, and then that opens up into your nasal cavity. Yeah? That's secreted by the lacrimal gland right here. All that's in tears. Yeah, all of that is in tears. Now the tarsal glands, which are in your palpebrae, right up over here, don't really secrete water. They secrete more of an oily kind of substance. All right, which then acts what is a permeability barrier that also helps protect your eyes from being desiccated. Right, that little oily substance right there. And then you can see the conjunctiva right here. This is the anterior pole of the eye, so the conjunctiva goes about up to the clear part of the eyeball right here. All right, so we got the palpebral conjunctiva and then the bulbar conjunctiva.
Dr. Gilbert?
Yeah.
What is the tarsal gland?
Oh, the tarsal gland secrete and a little bit of oil. So that acts, that protects your eye from drying out, from desiccating. Yeah. So I know a lot of times people might have to use eye drops because their eyes are dry. And I guess that helps to some degree, but eye drops are basically a watery solution, right? If you really want to protect your eye from drying out, you need what, like a little oily film over the cornea right here. When you use eye drops, guess what, one of the things that you're doing is washing out the secretions from the tarsal gland right here. So it might be just a temporary solution for you. Okay. Otherwise you just cry. You'd have to train yourself to cry. And I guess people can do that. Actors do that. Okay. Otherwise you'd have to be sad all the time. I wouldn't recommend that. Okay. All right, so those are accessory structures. And also there are some skeletal muscles because you can control where you look. Yeah. Oh, there's inflammation to your eyes, okay? For instance, if there's an irritant, there are blood vessels in the conjunctiva and in the eye that swell up and they start to leak, okay? And when they swell up, that gives, and what color is blood? Red, okay? When you have more blood going to that part of your body, it just looks a little bit redder as a result of that. So whenever they get inflamed, you have more blood going there and that gives a little red appearance. Just like if you were to scratch yourself, right, it would swell up and it would look kind of red because of additional blood flow, yeah.
So when you cry,
yeah.
Is that why your nose runs?
Yeah.
Tears are going down your nose?
Yeah. Some tears run right over the top of the palpebrae, but a lot of tears run down through the nasal lacrimal duct right into your nose. Yeah. As a matter of fact, there might even be somebody in here that can hold their nose closed like that. Right, and then pressurize their chest and can even get their lacrimal duct to squeak. Can anybody squeak their... No, my ears squeak. I get air going into my ears. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But I usually have some students in lab, you know, they can go squeak, squeak, squeak with their eye. I haven't really seen them blow bubbles or anything, but... How many tears can you cry? Well, they come from that lacrimal gland. I would guess that lacrimal gland can keep producing tears as long as, yeah, okay. Yeah, just like saliva, if you're eating, we could probably eat all day long, all month long, and not run out of saliva, right? As long as you stay well hydrated, as long as you have other water coming in your body. Because tears, you don't recover tears. They just leave your body, like sweat. Saliva is recovered because it ends up in your gastrointestinal tract, so it can be recycled. All right, so if you want to look at something, you don't necessarily always have to turn your head and exactly look at somebody. What can you do? You can turn your eyes. Like right now, I'm looking at you over here without turning my head. So there are some, skeletal muscles that attach to your eyeball that move your eyeball around, and those are what we call extrinsic eye muscles. And I had a picture of some of those on this slide, but anyway, there are six of them. There are four rectus, which means what? A rectus muscle is my ears got plugged up. I gotta do something. A rectus muscle is what? Just a straight muscle, which pulls straight back or straight to the side on an eyeball. All right, and then we have some oblique, which have a tendency to rotate the eyeball a little bit. So there are six extrinsic eye muscles. So I can see the superior rectus here. Here is the inferior rectus. And I'm not sure I know what aspect we're looking at right here. Let's just say we're looking from the side. So this would be what, the lateral rectus versus the medial rectus on the other side of the eyeball. For looking, and these would have to contract antagonistically for looking up, down, you know, abducting or adducting the eye. And then here is also a little muscle that we had on your list to know for when you did muscles in lab way back when. Right, here's the levator palpebrae superioris muscle, which is attached to the superior palpebrae right here, which opens your eyelids up. Okay. And as we get older, this muscle gets weaker and weaker and weaker, and our eyelids get a little bit bigger and bigger and bigger. A little bit more adipose tissue builds up in the superior palpebrae right here. And as we get older, we have more and more trouble opening our eyes. Right? And it's what? Very gradual process that might happen over a period of 25, maybe even 30 years, so that this superior palpebrae right here then starts to block this part of the eye right here, this dark little circle, that's what we call the pupil. And this is how light enters the eye, but if the palpebrae is sagging over the pupil right here, that blocks the light entering the eye. And so a lot of times people have to get surgery of this upper eyelid, right, so that it doesn't sag down over the pupil so that they can see properly, right? And it's actually kind of insidious. It sneaks up on people. And, of course, if you're in your 80s, you want to be able to have good vision, because what don't you want to do when you're in that age group? You want to have good vision so you don't do what? You don't trip on something and fall, right? So if you have grandma or grandpa at home, you know, you might always want to kind of check their pupils out. Make sure you can see them, because if you can see their pupils, what can they do? They can see you, right? So that's always a good thing to do. Okay, so that's not just cosmetic surgery. That's an important medical procedure. Okay. All right, so the extrinsic eye muscles. Right. Let's talk about the eyeball itself right now. Layers and different components of the eye. All right. Oh, so here you can see all the extrinsic eye muscles. That's a nice slide. Okay. Nice exam figure right here. And so I'm going to zoom into this region because I don't need to look at this one down over here. So you want to become very familiar with this. As a matter of fact, you probably should just even draw this one out. All right. Make sure you can label all the different parts. All right. So the eyeball, sometimes we call it the globe, has got three main layers. The most superficial layer is what color? Is white, right? And that's called the sclera. And the job of the sclera is it gives the eyeball its shape, and it's very, very tough. It protects the eye. It doesn't really contain many blood vessels. And it's as tough as shoe leather. Did you guys ever dissect an eyeball in lab yet? Yeah. And did you have to cut through the sclera? Difficult to do. Okay, unless you had a really sharp scissors or scalpel. Usually if you have a regular pair of scissors, you push and push and push and push, and then all of a sudden it pops through and a bunch of stuff squirts out at you, right? Okay, because the sclera is so tough. So here's the sclera. The next deeper layer right here, this is the choroid. Am I in the right spot? Yeah, I think I'm in the right spot, right? That probably looks red, or should look red, because that's the vascular layer. That's where blood vessels are. That's what's nourishing the sclera. And then the next layer is the retina, all right? And that's this like gold layer right here. And the retina contains photoreceptor cells. That's the business end of the eyeball that allows you to see things. So don't forget, you got sclera, choroid, and retina. And there are two different kinds of cells in the retina. They're called rod cells and cone cells. And light comes right in through this superficial part of the sclera, or actually the anterior part of the sclera, which is perfectly clear, goes through the lens, and it goes right to the posterior pole of the eye. That posterior pole has got a little depression in it called the macula lutea, and in the very center of the macula lutea, there's an area called the fovea centralis. And the fovea centralis is 100% cone cells. There are no rods, just cones. And cone cells allow you to see in color. They're very, very tiny cells. So cone cells allow you to see in color, but also in fine detail. So you can see a lot of fine detail with cone cells. The drawback is, in order for those cone cells to operate, they need bright light. So if I were to turn the lights down in the room and you were to look around, you couldn't see any color at all because there wouldn't be enough light for the cone cells to operate. All right, so there's mostly cone cells right here. And as you move out to the periphery, in your peripheral vision, those cone cells give way to rod cells. And rod cells work in dim light. They're bigger. The trade-off for rod cells, however, is since they're bigger, you don't have such good detail when you use those to look at something. So you can't discriminate fine detail. And the other thing is that they only see light in terms of shades of gray. So they work only for black and white. So in your peripheral vision, you don't have color vision. You can't see fine detail. In your central vision, you can see fine detail and you can see color. So when you want to look at something and concentrate on it, where do you normally look? Do you place that object in your peripheral vision or do you put it right in your central vision? Central vision, and you utilize those cells that make up the fovea centralis and the macula lutea right here. Okay, and unfortunately, this is one area of the retina that can degenerate, and that's called macular degeneration. All right, and it's relatively common kind of pathology. And a lot of times, a person's peripheral vision is spared, but the central vision is destroyed. So that when you look at something, you just see a smudge. Like put your hands right in front of your eyes, and you can't see anything. Right? And that's really pretty disturbing, because when you really want to appreciate something, what vision do you use? The one that's right in front of you, and that's the one that gets destroyed. So people with macular degeneration can't drive, right? Because you can't really drive with your peripheral vision. It's just not good enough. Yes, and yes, and we're learning about all the different combinations. Yeah, so there is family history is important, but there are probably some environmental influences as well, and it's age-related too. That means as you get older, it usually gets worse. Okay. All right, so that's the importance of this macula lutea right here. All right, so don't forget retina, choroid, sclera. And then here is the optic nerve. What cranial nerve is optic nerve? Is it number one?
No.
Number two, right? It's number two, and it is purely sensory. And the optic nerve attaches to the retina right here. And since there's the optic nerve right here, you don't have any photoreceptor cells. And this is what's called the optic disc, or otherwise known as the blind spot. Okay, I just want to finish my thought, and I'll answer your question. Okay. Okay, yeah, so, and the blind spot is a place in your retina where you can't perceive light. And so right now, you're looking around the room, and you have one blind spot in your right eye and another blind spot in your left eye, and you're probably looking around, but I don't see a blind spot. And that's true because your brain is such an important processing unit that it erases that blind spot from your vision and fills it in with information that it's getting from your other eye. Now, if you want to see your blind spot after class, I'll put a little diagram on the board, and if you use just one eye at a time, you can see your blind spot. I'll put a mark on the board, and if you look at it just right, it just totally disappears. You can't see it. All right, so I find that kind of interesting because a lot of times when you look at the world, you think you're seeing the world the way it is, but what is your brain doing? It's always making the world appear the way that you think it should be. Okay, and the blind spot is just another example of that. You want to know another example of that? How your brain changes the world? Well, you can put on glasses that flip the world upside down. They're prism glasses. And when you put those glasses on and look at the world, the ceiling is going to be down here and the floor is going to be up over here. All right, so how does that make you feel? Yeah, it's going to flip the world upside down. So it's going to make you feel kind of nauseated because it's really disturbing to look at the world like that. But what does your brain know? Your brain knows that the ceiling, which is down here, really belongs where? Up over here, right? And the floor, which is up over here, really belongs down over here. So after about 20 minutes, guess what your brain does, even though you're wearing the upside down glasses? It flips the world the way that you think that you should be looking at it. Okay, so that just illustrates the power of your brain. And then here's a really funny thing. When you take the glasses off, how does the world look? It looks upside down because your brain has adjusted for the upside downness of the glasses that you're using. And then it takes your brain about 5 minutes to flip it back the other way, and then you probably vomit a couple more times. But then you see that. So I don't really bring it into class. Maybe in lab if you want to do that sometime. That would be pretty good. Huh? Where do you get those? Oh, probably like Edmund Scientific. Okay, you might have to sign a disclaimer because you've got to be careful when you use those things. It's not that your brain will get stuck, like your mother would say, right? But it's kind of upsetting, all right, when you look at the world that way. Yeah, there was a question over here I wanted to get to. No? That's okay? Oh, yeah. Yes, they, okay, when I say they, I mean like me, for instance, because I'm red-green colorblind, I'm lacking cells that perceive red. All right, so I can see blue pretty well, I can see yellow very well, but red I can't see. So any color that has red in it, like purple is, from what I understand, a mixture of blue and red. So when I see something purple, it just looks blue to me. Red, yeah, red I can't see. I have no idea what color that. It looks dark. That could be dark green, it could be really dark blue, purple, red, any kind of color. Yeah, I think that's relatively rare to be fully colorblind. They would only see like a black and white picture, only shades of gray. Yeah. Yeah, there are different kinds. Yeah, there's red-green, and then there's blue-black, depending on exactly what cone cells. You have three kinds of cone cells, but we don't get into that in this class. And so I'm missing one kind of cone cell. So I can see some colors. As a matter of fact, actually, I can see yellow much better than most people can. Yeah.
So when you drive,
there's
a red light?
Oh, when I drive? Yeah, you guys should just stay out of my way. Because I can't see a red light during the day. I can see a red light at night, but I can't tell if it's a red light or a yellow light. But that's okay, because if I see a red or yellow, you should just stop anyway. And if I'm driving during the day and I see a stoplight and I don't see any color, I know it's what? It's red, so I stop. So it's not that difficult, because stoplights kind of have uniform appearance to them, unless like in Texas they hang them horizontal like that. But still, it still works for me pretty well. But you might ask, how is it that I can pass the colorblind test at DMV? Well, it's a nice government test. Okay, they give you a rectangle like this with three color dots in it, and they say, okay, what color is the middle dot? And I just say yellow, and they go, oh, hey, fantastic. And they say, okay, what's the bottom dot? Okay, and I say green, and they go, oh, well, you're not colorblind. And they say, well, okay, let's just check, see for sure if you're really not colorblind. They go, what's the top dot? And I go, red. And they go, yeah, you're not colorblind. So I always get a license that way. Okay, so that's due to those cone cells. And where do you have those cone cells? Your central vision for color vision, but also what? Fine detail. All right, so which layer, which of these three layers have blood vessels in them? The choroid, yeah, the choroid has the blood vessels. Oh, interesting story. I need to talk a lot more about the eye, but we don't have time to do that. All right, so the sclera, as it goes, all right, from the peripheral part of the eye to the anterior part of the eye, it changes from being very, very tough and thick to being very thin and delicate and transparent. And this is what we call the cornea. So the job of the cornea allows light into the eye. All right, and then light enters this anterior cavity. The anterior cavity is a space that is anterior to the lens right here, and it's filled with a fluid. It's filled with aqueous humor. All right, so, and that's just like water. So there's, and then you have the iris. The job of the iris is what? It's to either dilate or constrict. It adjusts the amount of light that's entering the eye. So it dilates when it's very dim out. It constricts when it's very bright outside. All right, so the aqueous humor flows around in these two parts of the anterior cavity. So this would be the anterior, what should we call this? Let's call this the anterior chamber of the anterior segment of the eye. And then this would be the posterior chamber. Right, so here's posterior chamber behind the iris, here's the anterior chamber, but nonetheless, these both still have aqueous humor in them. There is another cavity, right here. And this is the posterior segment that doesn't have aqueous humor in it. It has vitreous humor, which is like that jelly-like material. But again, that should be very clear because light has to move through this without being absorbed to hit the rod and cone cells back over here. Yeah, the vitreous humor helps give the eyeball shape, right? And it also helps keep the retina attached to the choroid so it doesn't fall away from the choroid. If it does, it's going to create a bigger blind spot. That's called a detached retina. That can be produced by what? Head trauma. Famous boxer had a detached retina. And everybody told him, don't go back into the ring and fight anymore, because maybe this other boxer knows where you might have a little vision deficit, so he's always going to punch you from that direction. But if you get hit in the head again, you might lose vision in that eye completely. All right, and he ignored everybody's advice, and he still earned probably $10 or $20 million going back into the ring and fighting. Who was that? Anybody know who that was? That was Sugar Ray Leonard. And he just really wasn't so worried because he was such a good boxer, hardly anybody ever hit him in the head. So, and he was able to continue fighting and he never did lose his vision. But that's something that could happen to any of us in an automobile accident or motorcycle accident. Okay. Oh, so it's just a big gelatinous plug that fills up this posterior segment of the eye, and it just holds the retina up against the choroid so it could get oxygen and nutrients, right, that for itself. But it's transparent. And this aqueous humor helps give shape to the cornea. All right, now let's talk about the lens right here. The lens changes shape. All right, so let's do a little experiment. When we look at something, all right, if we look across the room, we can't see everything in focus at one time. So if we put our hand, stretch our hand out in front of our face and stare at our fingernails, all right, if we stare and get those in focus, what does the back of the room look like or the front of the room look like? Is it in focus too? It looks out of focus. Now keep your hand there. Now look at the room, and what about your fingernails? Now, okay, they look blurry. So you can only pick one distance at which you want to see something in focus. That process of changing your distance of focus is called accommodation. So that's important that you know that. So the part of the eye that allows you to accommodate, to shift your focus from close in to far away, is the lens right here, right? And so light has to be focused on the retina for you to see it clearly and sharply. It's the job of the lens to adjust the distance at which light will be focused at, from either far away or close up. All right, so the lens has to be really, really thin if you're looking at things far away. All right, or it has to shrink, right, from this the lateral dimension, so it gets really thick in this anterior posterior dimension. It kind of puckers up. It gets really, really thick when you want to look at something close up, and that process again is called accommodation. So there's a muscle that pulls, produces tension on the lens or releases tension on the lens, and that's called the ciliary body right here. So the ciliary body is a muscle that adjusts the thickness of the lens so that you can see things close up or far away. All right, and that's something else that changes as you get older. All right, this lens gets a little bit stiffer, doesn't like to change shape very much, but it also takes longer to change shape when you're accommodating. So, for instance, you're probably aware of that because maybe you're driving down the 405 freeway and all of a sudden you come up on a car and it's driving maybe 35 miles an hour and you're going 65. Okay, what can you tell me about that person that's driving that car that's going 35? That's usually an elderly person, right? Almost all the time. Because, say, if you're in your 70s, what's one thing you don't ever want to get? A speeding ticket, because what will happen if you do? You'll get your license yanked, right, and you'll never drive again, and you'll lose that mobility, right? That's actually kind of a scary thing. So when you're driving on the 405 freeway, okay, and you're in that age group, what are you going to be looking at so you don't get a speeding ticket? You're going to be looking at your speedometer, right? And where's the speedometer? Right in front of your face, right? So that means you've accommodated so you can see things close up. All right, so you say, oh, I'm only going 35 miles an hour. That's fantastic. Because why? Won't get a speeding ticket. But what's another thing that you're going to be worried about? How, well, maybe not so much about that, but the last place you want to be probably is on the 405 freeway. You want to make sure you don't miss your exit, right? So you're driving, you're not getting a speeding ticket, you feel good about that, but then all of a sudden you're worried about missing your exit. So what do? You look away from your speedometer out the front windshield because you want to make sure you don't miss your exit, and what do you see? You know what? It's just blurry because you have to accommodate. And when you're older, it takes a while to accommodate. So you look out the front windshield, everything's blurry, 1001, 1002, 1003, and then everything pops into focus, and you see the exit down the road, and you go, ah, right, I didn't miss the exit. But now what are you worried about? How fast are you going? Are you speeding, right? So then you look back down at the speedometer. Where's the speedometer? Right in front of your face, and what do you see? Blurry, nothing, right? 1002, 1003, it pops into focus, and you go, all right, I'm going 35, I'm not speeding. You feel good. But now what are you worried about? Missing the exit again. So you look down the road, and what do you see? Nothing. It's all blurry until you accommodate, so you switch back and forth, back and forth. All right, so I just comment to everybody, you know, when you see those viejitos driving out there, just give them a lot of room, stay out of their way, and be nice to them because they just can't see as well as us young people anymore. All right, so don't forget that accommodation. What's accommodation due to? What parts of the eye? It's the lens, the ciliary body, and then the ligament that attaches the ciliary body to the lens, and that's what we call the suspensory ligaments. Okay, that's for accommodation. Yeah.
Is that because the lens stiffens?
Yeah, it gets stiffens. Yeah. Yeah, it gets stiffened. And actually, as the lens gets older, it opacifies as well. So it doesn't allow light to get through it quite so much anymore. And that's what produces cataracts. All right, so when the lens opacifies, that's called a cataract. And that's like looking through fog. And then when fog gets really, really thick, then this lens has to be removed. All right, and then you have to have other glasses. So that's the job of the lens. Yeah?
Why is it like very, very thin?
Very, very, because it's been preserved. It's been put in that preserving solution that turns living tissue into plastic. So it doesn't change shape anymore. But none of that tissue really is very lifelike. I mean, if you were to put your, that's why we always have you wear what? Gloves, and you should also wear goggles anytime you do dissection, because if you get that fluid in your eyes, it's going to change your cornea to plastic. All right, and then that's going to hurt really bad because you have some very sensitive nerve endings in the cornea, and probably if you damage the cornea, that will give you the most exquisite sensation of pain that you can experience. All right, so that's one reason to wear glasses. Okay, so you always should protect yourself against those chemicals that you use in lab because it changes that biological living tissue into plastic, basically, so it doesn't degrade as a result of that. All right, so that is pretty much everything, except you see a couple structures here, the cornea and the lens, I have an asterisk on. All right, and why do I have an asterisk there? All right. Well, notice the shape of the lens. All right, it kind of has a little curvature to it, and that helps focus light on the retina. Do you see anything else that has curvature to it that light goes through? Yeah, you saw the cornea right there. So here's the cornea. Notice that the cornea has a shape that kind of looks like a lens right here. And as a matter of fact, the part of the eye that focuses light on the retina has the most power in doing that is actually the cornea. The lens is important for changing your distance of focus, but the cornea actually helps, is the biggest lens that focuses light on the retina. So the two things that work to focus light on the retina so you can see things clearly are what? The lens and the cornea working together. And that's really the basic of a LASIK procedure, where somebody has a laser procedure done on their eye, okay? They don't change the shape of the lens with a laser, they change the shape of the cornea, right? And what people are interested in is that the distance between the retina and the cornea has to be such so that light focuses on it and the shape of the cornea has to match up with the distance between the cornea and the retina in order for you to see things clearly. Okay. So I think that's pretty much it for the eye. If we got some time, I can go back and talk about some other things about the eye, but we got to move on here. All right, the different layers of the eye, sometimes we call these tunics or coats of the eye. You know the three basic layers, right? But there's a fibrous tunic, which is made up of the sclera. All right, the vascular tunic is the choroid, right, as well as the ciliary body and the iris, that's highly vascular material. And then the sensory tunic is made up of the retina. Okay. You know, I think I'm going to move right on to hearing. All right, so what kind of sense is hearing? Is it a general or special sense? It's special because you only can hear things with your ears. And you only have two of them. All right, there are three main parts to the ear. Let's see if I can find some ears. Ah, this is a good figure. The three main parts, you have an outer ear, a middle ear, and an inner ear. All right, so the outer ear starts at the pinna right here. This is, or sometimes we call it the auricle of the ear, that helps focus sound energy into the external auditory meatus, which is entering your temporal bone. So this is all external ear, and then you have some sweat glands that secrete a modified waxy kind of sweat called ceruminous glands, secrete cerumen into the ear. And that cerumen is important because it helps protect the tympanic membrane from desiccating and from ripping and cracking. The tympanic membrane is the line of demarcation between the middle ear and the outer ear. And the tympanic membrane is just a membrane that vibrates back and forth when there's sound energy in the air. It vibrates back and forth. So how do you know that sound produces a vibration? Is there anything that you could think of that you've actually seen vibration as a result of sound?
Sound buffer.
A who?
Sound buffer.
Sound buffer?
Oh
yeah, your loudspeakers. Yeah, because if you look at your loudspeakers, if you take the grill off, as you turn the volume up, it sounds louder to your ears, but now what? You can see the diaphragms moving more and more and more. That's a good example. But there's an example I see almost daily, and that is when I'm driving around in my car, I look out the side rearview mirrors, and what are those rearview mirrors doing? They're bouncing back and forth like that. Okay, because I have my stereo on inside the car. I'm listening to talk radio or something. No, probably music, right? So if those mirrors are bouncing around like that, what can you tell me about this tympanic membrane right there? It's bouncing around just the same way those mirrors are, maybe even a little bit more, right? And that's maybe a little damaging to my ear. I'm not really sure. Probably shouldn't listen to really loud sound. Or maybe my ear is already damaged. That's why I need to have it so loud. I'm not sure. Okay? So those sound vibrations then vibrate the tympanic membrane, and then there are some little bones in the middle ear. We call those auditory ossicles, and those pass the vibrations into the inner ear. So here is the inner ear right here. So there's air in the external acoustic meatus. There's air in the middle ear, right? And the pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane should be the same so that the membrane can vibrate back and forth. If there's a buildup of pressure in the inner ear, or fluid or something, that's going to what? Dampen the tympanic membrane, and you won't be able to hear things. Like, for instance, when you get a middle ear infection, we call that otitis media, that plugs up your middle ear and you can't hear things very well at all. And little kids have that all the time. All right? Or maybe if you're in an airplane and the airplane takes off, then the pressure in the cabin of the airplane decreases really rapidly, but the pressure in your middle ear stays still, like at sea level, because we're at sea level right now, so it pushes the tympanic membrane all the way out, and then it can't vibrate, and that's going to disrupt your hearing as well. But as the tympanic membrane gets pushed out, how does that feel? It's painful, actually, okay? But there's a way that you can equalize the pressure from the middle ear and external ear, because here is that something that you had to learn, I think, in the first lab, the pharyngotympanic tube or the eustachian tube. Otherwise, sometimes we call it the auditory tube, right? It goes by all those different names. This goes from the pharynx, which is your throat, to the middle ear, so you can equalize the pressure by swallowing or chewing gum or doing a Valsalva maneuver, you know, by holding your breath and pressurizing your chest to help squirt some air up into that middle ear so that it relieves that pressure. Now, what happens if you're traveling with like a little one-year-old that maybe has otitis media and you're in an airplane and they're taking off? What is that little baby going to experience? Well, it's just going to experience that painful pressure in their ear, right? And there's really not much you can do about that. Because you can't, can you tell them, oh, hold your nose and pressurize your middle ear or clear your ears? No, they just don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah, you can certainly give them a bottle, any kind of swallowing. Yep, you can't give them like chewing gum or anything, but something to like work on a little bit. But if it's an adult, you can take maybe an antihistamine or a nasal decongestant or something to help you, but certainly I wouldn't prescribe anything like that for a neonate, right? If you're concerned about that, you'd have to talk to your pediatrician. Make sure you get advice from a pediatrician before you medicate somebody that age, right, when you're traveling. All right, so then sound. These bones right here are called auditory ossicles. All right, so here's the stapes, all right, the malleus and incus right here. These are the auditory ossicles. And the stapes is attached to another membrane which allows sound to enter the inner ear, and that's called the oval window. Because look at the footprint of the stapes right there. You see that it's kind of oval. It doesn't look perfectly round. All right, so sound enters the oval window, and it's going to vibrate fluid that's filled inside this part of the inner ear. This is what we call the cochlea. So there are three main bony parts to the inner ear. The thing that looks like a snail is the cochlea. Then there's a place right here that's called the vestibule. This is important for a sense of equilibrium. And then you see these three circular or semicircular structures. We call those the semicircular canals. And that's going to give us a third sense in the inner ear. So I just want to tell you what those are. The first sense in the cochlea is hearing. The second sense that we get from the vestibule right here is what we call static equilibrium. And then the sense of the semicircular canals is what we call kinetic equilibrium. And I need to tell you a little bit about those different kinds of equilibrium, but I'm going to talk to you about hearing first. Yeah, kinetic means motion. Okay, static means standing still. And then, of course, hearing is just what we hear right here. Okay, so here's a nice diagram of these auditory ossicles. We do have them in lab. If I had them here to show you, if I were to hold all three up like here between my fingers, you couldn't see them. Because they're so small, my fingers would completely cover them up anyway. All right, so they're really, really tiny bones. All right, so I'm going to start here next time. I'm going to probably, start on this slide right here next time, talking about hearing. All right, so don't forget the sign-in sheet. Who's got the sign-in sheet?